And good afternoon, it's Rob McClure here again, and we've got our book reading coming up. And before we do, a word from our sponsors.
Long-term Braidwood FM sponsor, Hockey's Braidwood, have a tilt tray that has a capability to carry 20-foot shipping containers and anything around 12.5 tonne. Hockey's can also supply you with bulk water deliveries, gravel, and they have a Kanga Mini for hire. You can phone the office on 4842 2286 or Stephen Hockey on 0429 422 286.
Capital Chemist Braidwood is open Monday to Friday 8am till 5pm and Saturday 8am to 12:30pm at their new larger premises at the Village Terrace. The friendly professional staff can assist you with medication packing to assist with managing your medication, having your scripts kept on file with the pharmacy, acquiring MedAdvisor, an online app to help order and manage your scripts that are on file, COVID-19 vaccinations. Capital Chemist Braidwood, proudly sponsoring Braidwood FM 88.9.
Ever thought of becoming a Freemason? Freemasonry is made up of men from all walks of life, serving their community while engaged in self-improvement, building friendships and seeking excellence in all pursuits. Lodge of Truth Braidwood has been in our community for over 160 years and we invite you to become a member of Braidwood's longest serving fraternity. If this interests you, please call Phil Schumark on 0427 422 046 for more information about membership. Sponsoring Braidwood FM 88.9.
Holdfast Distillery is Braidwood's first distillery, located in the basement of Braidwood Hotel at 180 Wallace Street. Their products are made with Australian grain and are distilled in their specially designed still to produce clean and crisp products. They select the best botanicals grown in Australia or sourced from overseas, ensuring there is no compromise in their products. Call 0406 083 963 for opening hours. Holdfast Distillery, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And a big thank you to our sponsors. They help make our station able to operate. Now, we've been we've finished our story of Ivanhoe, and we're now moving towards something very, very different. And I did start this last week, but we didn't get very far into it. So I'm going to start again because it was a public holiday, and some people may have missed it. But we're going to be looking at the work of H.P. Lovecraft, a couple of his stories, and one in particular, we're going to do two, but one of them is going to be The Shadow Over Innsmouth. Now, as I said last week, Lovecraft in actual fact was ahead of his time. He didn't make a lot of money from his writing in the 20s and 30s, but he is considered to be one of the leaders of modern horror fiction, and influenced a lot of authors, including people like Stephen King. And, of course, many of his short stories have been turned into movies or teleplays of some sort. And, of course, there's quite a famous tabletop role-playing game called The Call of Cthulhu, which is also grown out of Lovecraft's work. He was writing mostly in the 20s and 30s, and he has a strong sort of a science fiction element to some of his work. But what he wrote really did blaze a trail. And while he had a following, and he was writing for things like Weird Tales, he never made a lot of money. And he became much better known in the 50s and 60s and 70s and onwards. So H.P. Lovecraft, The Shadow Over Innsmouth. During the winter of 1927-28, officials of the federal government made a strange and secret investigation of certain conditions in the ancient Massachusetts seaport of Innsmouth. The public first learned of it in February, when a vast series of raids and arrests occurred, followed by the deliberate burning and dynamiting, under suitable precautions, of an enormous number of crumbling, worm-eaten and supposedly empty houses along the abandoned waterfront. Uninquiring souls let this occurrence pass as one of the major clashes in a spasmodic war on liquor. Keener news followers, however, wondered at the prodigious number of arrests, the abnormally large force of men used in making them, and the secrecy surrounding the disposal of the prisoners. No trials, or even definite charges, were reported, nor were there any of the captives seen thereafter in the regular jails of the nation. there were vague statements about disease and concentration camps, and later about dispersal in various naval and military prisons, but nothing positive ever developed. Innsmouth itself was left almost depopulated, and is even now only beginning to show signs of a sluggishly revived existence. Complaints from many liberal organisations were met with long confidential discussions, and representatives were taken on trips to certain camps and prisons. As a result, these societies became surprisingly passive and reticent. Newspaper men were harder to manage, but seemed largely to cooperate with the government in the end. Only one paper, a tabloid always discounted because of its wild policy, mentioned the deep-diving submarine that discharged torpedoes downward in the marine abyss just beyond Devil Reef. That item, gathered by chance in a haunt of sailors, seemed indeed rather far-fetched, since the low black reef lies a full mile and a half out from Innsmouth Harbour. People around the country and in the nearby towns muttered a great deal among themselves, but said very little to the outer world. They had talked about dying and half-deserted Innsmouth for nearly a century, and nothing new could be wilder or more hideous than what they had whispered and hinted years before. Many things had taught them secretiveness, and there was now no need to exert pressure on them. Besides, they really knew very little, for wide salt marshes, desolate and unpeopled, keep neighbours off from Innsmouth on the landward side. But at last I'm going to defy the ban on speech about this thing. Results, I am certain, are so thorough that no public harm, save a shock of repulsion, could ever accrue from a hinting of what was found by those horrified raiders at Innsmouth. Besides, what was found might possibly have more than one explanation. I do not know just how much of the whole tale has been told, even to me, and I have many reasons for not wishing to probe deeper. For my contact with this affair has been closer than that of any other layman, and I have carried away impressions which are yet to drive me to drastic measures. It was I who fled frantically out of Innsmouth in the early morning hours of July 16, 1927, and whose frightened appeals for government inquiry and action brought on the whole reported episode. I was willing enough to stay mute while the affair was fresh and uncertain, but now that it is an old story with public interest and curiosity gone, I have an odd craving to whisper about those few frightful hours in that ill-rumoured and evilly shadowed seaport of death and blasphemous abnormality. The mere telling helps me to restore confidence in my own faculties, to reassure myself that I was not simply the first to succumb to a contagious nightmare hallucination. It helps me, too, in making up my mind regarding a certain terrible step which lies ahead of me. I never heard of Innsmouth till the day before I saw it for the first and, so far, the last time. I was celebrating my coming of age by a tour of New England, sightseeing, antiquarian and genealogical, and had planned to go directly from ancient Newburyport to Arkham, whence my mother's family was derived. I had no car, but was travelling by train, trolley and motor coach, always seeking the cheapest possible route. In Newburyport, they told me that the steam train was the thing to take to Arkham, and it was only at the station ticket office, when I demurred at the high fare, that I learned about Innsmouth. The stout, shrewd-faced agent whose speech showed him to be no local man seemed sympathetic towards my efforts at economy and made a suggestion that none of my other informants had offered. "You could take that old bus, I suppose," he said with a certain hesitation. "But it ain't thought much of hereabouts. It goes through Innsmouth. You may have heard about that, and so the people don't like it. Run by an Innsmouth fellow, Joe Sargent, but never gets any custom from here, or Arkham either, I guess. Wonder it keeps running at all. Suppose it's cheap enough, but I never see more'n two or three people in it. Nobody but these Innsmouth folk. Leaves the square front of Hammond's drugstore at 10 a.m. and 7 p.m. unless they've changed lately. Looks like a terrible rattle-trap. I've never been in it." That was the first I ever heard of shadowed Innsmouth. Any reference to a town not shown on common maps or listed in recent guidebooks would have interested me, and the agent's odd manner of allusion roused something like real curiosity. An odd manner of allusion. A town able to inspire such dislike in its neighbours, I thought, must be at least rather unusual and worthy of a tourist's attention. If it came before Arkham, I would stop off there, and so I asked the agent to tell me something about it. He was very deliberate and spoke with an air of feeling slightly superior to what he said. Innsmouth? Well, it's a queer kind of town down at the mouth of the Manuxet. Used to be almost a city, quite a port before the war of 1812. All gone to pieces in the last 100 years or so. No railroad now. B&M never went through, and the branch line from Rowley was given up, oh, years and years ago. More empty houses than there are people, I guess, and no business to speak of except fishing and lobstering. Everybody trades mostly here or in Arkham or Ipswich. Once they had quite a few mills, but nothing's left now except one gold refinery running on the leanest kind of part-time. That refinery, though, used to be a big thing, and old man Marsh, who owns it, must be richer than Croesus. Queer old duck, though, and sticks mighty close in his home. He's supposed to have developed some skin disease or deformity late in life that makes him keep out of sight. Grandson of Captain Obed Marsh, who founded the business. His mother seems to have been some kind of foreigner, they say a South Sea Islander, so everybody raised Cain when he married an Ipswich girl 50 years ago. They always do that about Innsmouth people, and folks here and hereabouts always try to cover up any Innsmouth blood they have in them. But Marsh's children and grandchildren look just like anybody else's, so far as I can see. I've had 'em pointed out to me there, though, come to think of it, the elder children don't seem to be round lately. I never saw the old man. And why is everybody so down on Innsmouth? Well, young fellow, you mustn't take too much stock in what people around here say. They're hard to get started, but once they get started, they never let up. They've been telling things about Innsmouth, whispering them mostly, for the last 100 years, I guess, and I gather they're more scared than anything else. Some of the stories would make you laugh, about old Captain Marsh driving bargains with the devil and bringing imps out of hell to live in Innsmouth, or about some kind of devil worship and awful sacrifices in some place near the wharves that people stumbled on around 1845 or thereabouts. But I come from Panton, Vermont, and that kind of story don't go down with me. You ought to hear, though, that some of the old-timers tell about the Black Reef off the coast. Devil Reef, they call it. It's well above water a good part of the time, and never much below it, but at that you could hardly call it an island. The story is that there's a whole legion of devils, seems sometimes, on that reef, sprawled about or darting in and out of some kind of caves near the top. It's rugged and uneven thing, good bit over a mile out. Toward the end of a shipping day, sailors used to make big detours just to avoid it. That is, sailors that didn't hail from Innsmouth. One of the things they had against old Captain Marsh was that he was supposed to land on it sometimes at night when the tide was right. Or maybe he did. For I dare say the rock formation was interesting, and it's just barely possible he was looking for pirate loot, and maybe finding it. But there was talk of his dealing with demons there. Fact is, I guess on the whole, it was really the captain that gave the bad reputation to the reef. That was before the big epidemic of 1846, when over half the folks in Innsmouth was carried off. They never did quite figure out what the trouble was, but it was probably some foreign kind of disease brought from China or somewhere by the shipping. It surely was bad enough. There was riots over it and all sorts of ghastly doings that I don't believe ever got outside of town, and it left the place in awful shape. Never came back. There can't be more than 300 or 400 people living there now. But the real thing behind the way folks feel is simply race prejudice. And I don't say I'm blaming those that hold it. I hate those Innes folks myself, and I wouldn't care to go to their town. I suppose you know, though I can see you're a Westerner by your talk, what a lot of our New England ships used to have to do with queer ports in Africa, Asia, the South Seas, and everywhere else, and what queer kinds of people they sometimes brought back with them. You probably heard about the sailor man that came home with a Chinese wife, and maybe you know there's still a bunch of Fiji Islanders somewhere around Cape Cod. Well, there must be something like that back of the Innesmouth people. The place always was badly cut off from the rest of the country by marshes and creeks. We can't be sure about the ins and outs of the matter, but it's pretty clear that old Captain Marsh must have brought home some odd specimens when he had all three of his ships in commission back in the 20s and 30s. There certainly is a strange kind of streak in the Innesmouth folks today. I don't know how to explain it, but it sort of makes you crawl. You notice a little insurgent if you take his bus. Some of them have queer, narrow heads with flat noses and bulgy, starry eyes that never seem to shut, and their skin ain't quite right, rough and scabby, and the sides of their necks are all shriveled or creased up. They get bald, too, very young. The older fellows, they look the worst. Fact is, I don't believe I've ever seen a very old chap of that kind. Guess they must die of looking in the glass. Animals hate them. They used to have lots of horse trouble before autos came in. Nobody around here or in Arkham or Ipswich will have anything to do with them. And they act kind of offish themselves when they come to town or when anyone tries to fish on their grounds. Queer how fish are always thick off Innesmouth Harbour, and when there ain't any anywhere else around. But just try to fish there yourself and see how the folks chase you off. Those people used to come here on the railroad, walking and taking the train at Raleigh after the branch was dropped, but now they use that bus. Yeah, there's a hotel in Innesmouth called the Gilman House, but I don't believe it can mount to much. I wouldn't advise you to try it. Better stay over here and take the 10 o'clock bus tomorrow morning. Then you can get an evening bus there for Arkham at 8 o'clock. There was a factory inspector who stopped at Gilman a couple of years ago. He had a lot of unpleasant hints about the place. Seems they get a queer crowd there, for this fellow heard voices in other rooms, though most of them was empty. That gave him the shivers. It was foreign talk, he thought, but he said the bad thing about it was the kind of voice that sometimes spoke. It sounded so unnatural, slopping-like, he said, and he didn't dare undress and go to sleep. Just waded up and lit out first thing in the morning. The talk went on nearly all night. This fellow, Casey, his name was, had a lot to say about how the Innesmouth folks watched him. It seemed kind of on guard. He found the Marsh Refinery a queer place. It's an old mill on the lower falls of the Nooksett. What he said tallied up with what I'd heard. Books in bad shape, no clear account of any kind of dealings. You know, it's always been kind of a mystery where the Marshes did get the gold they refine. They've never seemed to do much buying in that line, but years ago they shipped out an enormous lot of ingots. Used to be talk of queer foreign kind of jewellery that the sailors and refinery men sometimes sold on the sly, or that was seen once or twice on some of the Marsh women folks. People allowed maybe old Captain Obed traded for it in some heathen port, especially since he was always ordering stacks of glass beads and trinkets such as seafaring men used to get for native trade. Others thought and still think he'd found an old pirate cache out on Devil's Reef. But here's a funny thing. The old captain's been dead these 60 years, and there ain't been a good-sized ship out of that place since the Civil War, but just the same, the Marshes still keep on buying a few of those native trade things. Mostly glass and rubber gewgaws, they tell me. Maybe the Innesmouth folks like them to look at themselves. God knows they've gotten to be about as bad as South Sea cannibals and Guinea savages. The plague of 46 must have taken off the best blood in the place. Anyway, they're a doubtful lot now, and the Marshes and the other rich folks are as bad as any. As I told you, there probably ain't more than 400 people in the whole town in spite of all the streets they say there are. I guess they're what they call white trash down south. Lawless and sly and full of secret doings. They get a lot of fish and lobsters and do export them by truck. Queer how the fish swarm, there and nowhere else. Nobody can ever keep track of these people, and state school officials and census men, they have a devil of a time. You can bet that prying strangers ain't welcome around Innsmouth. I've heard personally of more than one business or government man that's disappeared there. There's loose talk of one who went crazy and is out at Danvers now. They must have fixed up some awful scare on that fella. That's why I wouldn't go at night if I was you. I've never been there and I have no wish to go. But I guess a daytime trip couldn't hurt you, even though the people hereabouts will advise you not to make it. If you're just sightseeing and looking for old-time stuff, Innsmouth ought to be quite the place for you. And so I spent part of that evening in the Newburyport Public Library looking up data about Innsmouth. When I had tried to question the natives in the shops and the lunchroom, the garages and the fire station, I found them even harder to get started than the ticket agent had predicted, and realised that I could not spare the time to overcome their first instinctive reticences. They had a kind of obscure suspiciousness, as if there was something amiss with anyone too much interested in Innsmouth. At the YMCA, where I was stopping, the clerk merely discouraged my going to such a dismal, decadent place, and the people at the library showed much the same attitude. Clearly, in the eyes of the educated, Innsmouth was merely an exaggerated case of civic degeneration. The Essex County histories on the library shelves had very little to say except that the town was founded in 1643, noted for shipbuilding before the Revolution, a seat of great marine prosperity in the early 19th century, and later a minor factory centre using the Manuxet as power. The epidemic and riots of 1846 were very sparsely treated, as if they formed a discredit to the county. References to decline were few, though the significance of the later record was unmistakable. After the Civil War, all industrial life was confined to the Marsh Refining Company, and the marketing of gold ingots formed the only remaining bit of major commerce, aside from the eternal fishing. That fishing paid less and less as the price of the commodity fell and large-scale corporations offered competition, but there was never a dearth of fish around Innsmouth Harbour. Foreigners seldom settled there, and there was some discreetly veiled evidence that a number of Poles and Portuguese who had tried it had been scattered in peculiarly drastic fashion. Most interesting of all was a glancing reference to the strange jewellery vaguely associated with Innsmouth. It had evidently impressed the whole countryside more than a little, for mention was made of specimens in the Museum of Miskatonic University at Arkham, and in the display room of the Newburyport Historical Society. The fragmentary descriptions of these things were bald and prosaic, but they hinted to me an undercurrent of persistent strangeness. Something about them seemed so odd and provocative that I could not put them out of my mind, and despite the relative lateness of the hour, I resolved to see the local sample, said to be a large, queerly proportioned thing, evidently meant for a tiara, if it could possibly be arranged. The librarian gave me a note of introduction to the curator of the society, a Miss Anna Tilton, who lived nearby, and after a brief explanation, that ancient gentlewoman was kind enough to pilot me into the closed building, since the hour was not outrageously late. The collection was a notable one indeed, but in my present mood I had eyes for nothing but the bizarre object which glistened in a corner cupboard under the electric lights. It took no excessive sensitiveness to beauty to make me literally gasp at the strange, unearthly splendour of the alien, opulent fantasy that rested there on a purple velvet cushion. Even now I can hardly describe what I saw, though it was clearly enough a sort of tiara, as the description had said. It was tall in front, and with a very large and curiously irregular periphery, as if designed for a head of almost freakishly elliptical outline. The material seemed to be predominantly gold, though a weird lighter lustrousness hinted at some strange alloy with an equally beautiful and scarcely identifiable metal. its condition was almost perfect, and one could have spent hours in studying the striking and puzzlingly untraditional designs, some simply geometrical and some plainly marine, chased or moulded in high relief on its surface with a craftsmanship of incredible skill and grace. The longer I looked, the more the thing fascinated me. And in this fascination, there was a curiously disturbing element hardly to be classified or accounted for. At first I decided that it was the queer, otherworldly quality of the art which made me uneasy. All other art objects I had ever seen either belonged to some known racial or national stream, or else were consciously modernistic defiances of every recognised stream. This tiara was neither. It clearly belonged to some settled technique of infinite maturity and perfection, yet that technique was utterly remote from any Eastern or Western, ancient or modern, which I had ever heard of or seen exemplified. It was as if the workmanship were that of another planet. However, I soon saw that my uneasiness had a second and perhaps equally potent source, residing in the pictorial and mathematical suggestions of the strange design. The patterns all hinted of remote secrets and unimaginable abysses in time and space, and the monotonously aquatic nature of the reliefs became almost sinister. Among these reliefs were fabulous monsters of abhorrent grotesqueness and malignity, half ichthyic and half Batrachian in suggestion, which one could not dissociate from certain haunting and uncomfortable sense of pseudo-memory, as if they called up some image from the deep cells and tissues whose retentive functions are wholly primal and awesomely ancestral. At times, I fancied that every contour of these blasphemous fish frogs was overflowing with the ultimate quintessence of unknown and inhuman evil. In odd contrast to the tiara's aspect was its brief and prosy history as related by Miss Tilton. It had been pawned for a ridiculous sum at a shop in State Street in 1874, by a drunken Innsmouth man, shortly afterwards killed in a brawl. The society had acquired it directly from the pawnbroker, at once giving it a display worthy of its quality. It was labelled as of probable East Indian or Indo-Chinese provenance, though the attribution was frankly tentative. Miss Tilton, comparing all possible hypotheses regarding its origin and its presence in New England, was inclined to believe that it formed part of some exotic pirate hoard discovered by old Captain Obed Marsh. This view was surely not weakened by the insistent offers of purchase at a high price which the Marshes began to make as soon as they knew of its presence, and which they repeated to this day, despite the Society's unvarying determination not to sell. As the good lady showed me out of the building, she made it clear that the pirate theory of the Marsh fortune was a popular one among the intelligent people of the region. Her own attitude towards shadowed Innsmouth, which she had never seen, was one of disgust at a community slipping far down the cultural scale, and she assured me that the rumours of devil worship were partly justified by a peculiar secret cult which had gained force there and engulfed all the Orthodox churches. It was called, she said, the Esoteric Order of Dagon, and was undoubtedly a debased quasi-pagan thing imported from the Easter century before, at a time when the Innsmouth fisheries seemed to be going barren. Its persistence among a simple people was quite natural in view of the sudden and permanent return of abundantly fine fishing, and it soon came to be the greatest influence on the town, replacing Freemasonry altogether and taking up headquarters in the old Masonic Hall on New Church Green. All this, to the pious Miss Tilton, formed an excellent reason for shunning the ancient town of decay and desolation, but to me it was merely a fresh incentive. To my architectural and historical anticipations was now added an acute anthropological zeal, and I could scarcely sleep in my small room at the Y. As a result, the night wore away. Shortly before 10 the next morning, I stood with one small valise in front of Hammond's drugstore in Old Market Square, waiting for the Innsmouth bus. As the hour for its arrival drew near, I noticed a general drift of the loungers to other places up the street or to the Ideal Lunch across the square. Evidently the ticket agent had not exaggerated the dislike which local people bore towards Innsmouth and its denizens. In a few moments, a small motor coach of extreme decrepitude and dirty grey colour rattled down State Street, made a turn, and drew up at the curb beside me. I felt immediately that it was the right one, a guess which the half-illegible sign on the windshield, Arkham, Innsmouth, Newburyport, soon verified. There were only three passengers, dark, unkempt men of sullen visage and somewhat youthful cast. And when the vehicle stopped, they clumsily shambled out and began walking up State Street in a silent, almost furtive fashion. The driver also alighted, and I watched him as he went into the drugstore to make some purchase. This, I reflected, must be the Joe Sargent mentioned by the ticket agent, and even before I noticed any details, there spread over me a wave of spontaneous aversion which could neither be checked nor explained. It suddenly struck me as very natural that the local people should not wish to ride on a bus owned and driven by this man, or to visit any oftener than possible the habitat of such a man and his kinsfolk. When the driver came out of the store, I looked at him more carefully and tried to determine the source of my evil impression. He was a thin, stooped-shouldered man, not much under 6 feet tall, dressed in a shabby blue civilian clothes and wearing a frayed grey golf cap. His age was perhaps 35, but the odd deep creases on the sides of his neck made him seem older when one did not study his dull, expressionless face. He had a narrow head, bulging, watery blue eyes that seemed never to wink, a flat nose, a receding forehead, and a chin, and singularly undeveloped ears. His long, thick lip of coarse-pored greyish cheeks seemed almost beardless, except for some sparse yellow hairs that straggled and curled in irregular patches, and in places on the surface seemed queerly irregular, as if peeling from some cutaneous disease. His hands were large and heavily veined, and had a very unusual greyish-blue tinge. The fingers were strikingly short in proportion to the rest of the structure, and seemed to have a tendency to curl closely into the huge palm. As he walked towards the bus, I observed his peculiarly shambling gait and saw that his feet were inordinately immense. The more I studied them, the more I wondered how he could buy any shoes to fit them. A certain greasiness about the fellow increased my dislike. He was evidently given to working or lounging around the fish docks and carried with him much of their characteristic smell. Just what foreign blood was in him, I could not even guess. His oddity certainly did not look Asiatic, Polynesian, Levantine, or Negroid, yet I could see why people found him alien. I myself would have thought of biological degeneration rather than alienage. I was sorry when I saw that there would be no other passengers on the bus. Somehow, I did not like the idea of riding alone with this driver, but as leaving time obviously approached, I conquered my qualms and followed the man aboard, extending him a dollar bill and murmuring the single word, Innsmouth. He looked curious at me for a second as he returned 40 cents change, without speaking. I took a seat far behind him, but on the same side of the bus, since I wished to watch the shore during the journey. At length the decrepit vehicle started with a jerk and rattled noisily past the old brick buildings of State Street amidst a cloud of vapour from the exhaust. Glancing at the people on the sidewalks, I thought I detected in them a curious wish to avoid looking at the bus, or at least a wish to avoid seeming to look at it. Then we turned to the left into High Street, where the going was smoother, flying by stately old mansions of the early Republic and still older colonial farmhouses, passing the Lower Green and Parker River, and finally emerging into a long, monotonous stretch of open shore country. The day was warm and sunny, but the landscape of sand, sedge grass and stunted shrubbery became more and more desolate as we proceeded. Out of the window I could see the blue water and the sandy line of Plum Island, and we presently drew very near the beach as our narrow road veered off from the main highway to Rowley and Ipswich. There were no visible houses, and I could tell by the state of the road that traffic was very light hereabouts. The small, weather-worn telephone poles carried only two wires. Now and then we crossed rude wooden bridges over tidal creeks that wound far inland and promoted the general isolation of the region. Once in a while I noticed dead stumps and crumbling foundation walls above the drifting sand and recalled the old tradition quoted in one of the histories I had read that this was once a fertile and thickly settled countryside. The change, it was said, came simultaneously with the Innsmouth epidemic of 1846 and was thought by simple folk to have a dark connection with hidden forces of evil. Actually, it was caused by the unwise cutting of woodlands near the shore, which robbed the soil of its best protection and opened the way for waves of windblown sand. At last we lost sight of Plum Island and saw the vast expanse of the open Atlantic on our left. Our narrow course began to climb steeply, and I felt a singular sense of disquiet in looking at the lonely crest ahead, where the rutted roadway met the sky. It was as if the bus were about to keep on in its ascent, leaving the sane earth altogether and merging with the unknown arcana of the upper air and cryptical sky. The smell of the sea took on ominous implications, and the silent driver's bent, rigid back and narrow head became more and more hateful. As I looked at him, I saw that the back of his head was almost as hairless as his face, having only a few straggling yellow strands upon a grey scabrous surface. Then we reached the crest and beheld the outspread valley beyond, where the Manoxet joins the sea just north of the long line of cliffs that culminate in Kingsport Head and veer off towards Cape Ann. On the far misty horizon, I could just make out the dizzy profile of the head topped by the queer ancient house of which so many legends are told, but for the moment, all my attention was captured by a nearer panorama just below me. I had, I realized, come face to face with rumour-shadowed Innsmouth. And that's our book reading for this week, Braidwood. I hope that you're enjoying Shadow Over Innsmouth by Lovecraft. And I'll be back with more next week. Until then, have a safe and a joyous week. Bye-bye.